Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With Trump insulting the six-foot-tall minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee today as Little Adam Schiff, we will begin with the injection of poisonous politics into America's nonpartisan intelligence community by the Nunes memo and efforts by Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee to get their rebuttal out to the public following the release of the absurd conspiratorial fiction which Nunes and Trump concocted. Mark Fenster, a professor at the Levin School of Law at the University of Florida and author of Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture, joins us to discuss how the political landscape has been turned on its head now that liberals are defending agencies they have traditionally been more critical of as Trump attacks the integrity of U.S. law enforcement agencies to stop their investigations into his possible criminal activities in a cover-up which Republicans have not just enabled, but have joined in. Then we'll look into the brazen example of the fox guarding the henhouse with the director of the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, who Trump has moonlighting as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, destroying the agency from within by giving a get-out-of-jail-free pass to Equifax, who allowed the personal data of 143 million Americans to get into the hands of criminal hackers. Amanda Werner, the arbitration campaign manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, who is now a campaign strategist for public justice, joins us to discuss how Mulvaney is also giving a free pass to predatory payday lenders who will be holding their annual trade association gathering at one of Trump's resorts. Then finally, with the START treaty between Russia and the United States set to go into effect on Monday, we'll examine the new nuclear posture review with Jonathan Granoff, the president of the Global Security Institute, and discuss the trillions that Trump will waste from his promise in the State of the Union to, quote, modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal. We'll assess the dangerous folly of mirroring the reckless Russian doctrine of deploying more low-yield nuclear weapons that increases the potential for their use. Joining us now is Mark Fenster, a professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida. His research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on government regulation. He's the author of Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Fenster.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
So this so-called the storm that was unleashed by Devin Nunes, who are now in limbo. The Democrats, of course, are trying to get their rebuttal released, and it has to go through the White House, and it could well go through a redaction process. And Donald Trump, of course, is now insulting Adam Schiff, the minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and he's not necessarily going to do the smart thing, which would be to let it come out. He may well try and hold it up. So at this point, I don't know what to say about it, except that it doesn't matter, does it, in terms of facts, evidence, in terms of the people inside the Fox News bubble? They're already sold on this, right?
So it seems as though Trump is mostly talking to a fairly small audience, or at least a narrower audience than the general public. He seems to be talking to Republican House members, a smaller majority, if at all a majority, of Republican senators, and those folks who are already with him.
Well, but the strategy here is because the Tea Party is the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party, and they're all in with Trump and Fox, and they'll make life miserable for any moderate Republican who doesn't go along and primary them with a nutcase who's further to the right than they are. That's what's holding Trump's caucus together, right?
That seems right, at least at present. And he's not doing anything to tack in a different direction.
So what's wrong with the majority of people in this country? Why can't truth and logic prevail?
that's a complicated question. Part of it is an issue of the presidential election and the extent to which electoral college leads to a victory for someone who didn't win the popular vote. Part of it has to do with an enormous number of factors that are driving the Republican Party. Gerrymandering in the House that leads to more conservative and radicalized members. The various institutions that are supposed to protect us also have their own downsides, and that's what we're living with right now.
Well, it is an amazing situation to go through this on a daily basis and trying to follow Trump and his antics. And a part of it, I think, is a deliberate distraction. On the other hand, I think he's so incompetent and out of his depth that he spreads this chaos around because all he can do is government by stunt. And I just wonder at what point everybody gets tired of it, even his own people, because he keeps throwing out the same tired old cliches about making America great again. Obviously, this tax bill has gone a long way to satisfying the Republicans, but even there, it's a con. So I don't know. I mean, I could give you a litany of what this man has done in destroying American institutions. And, he's already started out supporting Brexit, which has weakened the EU. He's never committed to NATO, which is weakening NATO. He's attacked the judiciary, judges. He's attacked the press relentlessly. He's attacked the Department of Justice. He's now attacking the FBI as well. And if any FBI agent gets killed by one of the Bundy brothers or some crackpot like that with assault rifles, the blood will be on Trump's hands. And in general, he's destroyed civility and civilized political discourse in this country. So that's an amazing achievement for this man in terms of doing Putin's job for him. What's going to stop him?
That's a good question. I mean, people were asking the same question about Nixon in 1973. And it was a combination of the existing American institutions, individuals stepping up and playing key roles in trying to defend American institutions against a president who was trying to defend himself in an indefensible situation and trying to survive a political storm of its own making, as well as just plain luck. And, likely scenario is we can't imagine at this point what will happen next. But clearly something will happen, whether we have to wait until the midterm elections, assuming things continue to go in the same direction, then that's what we'll wait for. I mean, obviously, the worst thing that could happen would be a catastrophic event that finally turns things around. And that's what we would have to hope to avoid. And with someone like Trump, who knows?
Well, a lot of people on the left think that he might even start a war with North Korea to rescue his poll numbers. But again, I'm speaking with Mark Fenster, professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida, whose research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on government regulations. He's the author of The Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. But Mark, when you mention Richard Nixon as a comparison with Watergate, first of all, there was bipartisanship in those days. And furthermore, the legislative branch, the first branch of government, was actually doing its job in terms of separations of power. Now you have the entire legislative branch in collusion with the executive branch, even though the person in charge of the executive branch is totally out to lunch. Nixon wasn't. Nixon was one of the most competent presidents we've ever had. He knew more about international relations. He started the EPA. He would have given us national health of single payer if Ted Kennedy hadn't thought he could do better with another president. The comparison, there's no comparison, I mean, as far as I can tell.
Well, I wasn't comparing, to be clear, I wasn't comparing Nixon to Trump. I was comparing the circumstances surrounding Watergate to the circumstances now. And The political alignment was absolutely different in 1972 through 1974 to what it is now. You had Democrats with majorities, I think, in both the Senate and the House. But there wasn't the spirit of bipartisanship you're discussing here was not was different then, because the Republicans and Democrats hadn't sorted themselves in the way that they have now, and their sorting of themselves was in large part a product of Nixon himself, who, while he did have certain qualities that we might fondly remember, particularly in an age of Trump, he also had several qualities that we might properly disdain, including a Southern strategy that helped lead ultimately to what we experience today with Jeff Sessions, for example, and Donald Trump. So, I mean, the distinction, I agree, isn't perfect, but it is similar. So you had at the time Southern Democrats who found themselves in a situation where their own districts were voting strongly for Nixon and felt obliged to assist the president in ways that you would never see a Democrat now. And you had moderate Republicans at the time who were more willing to be questioning of Nixon as this sorting was beginning to occur, and Nixon's support in some places in the Northeast and Midwest wasn't as strong. So while I agree the analogy isn't perfect, the ultimate resignation of Richard Nixon was not a sort of smooth transition towards, oh my God, Watergate, and oh my God, all these other things that we're learning about Nixon, we have to get rid of him. There was a great deal of resistance to the kind of legislative oversight that Democrats were attempting to do that was orchestrated both by Republican congresspeople and by the White House.
Well, of course, the biggest difference, I think, between the Nixon era and now is that we had back then the Fairness Doctrine, which limited the media moguls from using their media networks as a private soapbox to propagate their own personal views. And that was gotten rid of under President Reagan. And that has led directly to Fox News and Limbaugh.
Well, to be clear, just to push back against that, Fox News is a cable network which would not have been subject to the Fairness Doctrine. Only the major over-the-air broadcast networks were subject to the Fairness Doctrine. That was one of the attractions of cable, was that you would the cable networks are not subject to the level of regulation that at the time, in particular, the over-the-air broadcast networks were subject to. But your point is well taken, that we are in a much different media scape than we were then, which has its positives and negatives, and I think certainly with Fox News, more to the negative. But, you know, the sources of news at the time in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s might have been broader. But the local newspapers played a much more important role then, and the local newspapers were not subject to the Fairness Doctrine, and they were oftentimes strongly allied, particularly in the South, with Jim Crow-like government. So, it's more complicated than just saying that things were better under Nixon. Things were pretty bad then, too.
Well, I just have not experienced any historical examples in terms of American press that we have with Fox News, in the extent to which it is the voluntary arm of the Republican Party, the Pravda of the Republican Party, or the Ministry of Truth.
Oh, I agree entirely. I mean, the extent of its reach far surpasses the reach of, you know, individual local newspapers throughout the South and throughout the West, for that matter, that might have been that were promoting Nixon and defending Nixon. So I agree with that. I mean, that is, Fox News creates a news bubble or a sort of self-enclosed, self-validating source of information that is distinct and particularly dangerous and frightening. But it only reaches, which is not an only, because numerically it's a lot of people, but it only reaches the people that it reaches, and not everyone watches Fox News. And so when it comes to elections in the wake of the 2 years of Trump and 4 years of Trump, we'll have to see what happens.
Well, but Rupert Murdoch, one of the reasons he sold off his entertainment assets was he wants to buy more television stations, particularly in swing states, to have an even greater influence. He's already got a lot of TV stations, as you know. And I find him to be one of the most irresponsible people on the planet, because he's basically creating this kind of bubble where people believe all this Nunes nonsense. But worse than that, He apparently, according to the Michael Wolff book, gets off the phone with Trump and says, my God, what an effing idiot he is. At the same time, he basically gives him his daily talking points and seems to be running the show.
Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the incompetence of the Trump administration and of Donald Trump will and of the Republicans who are with him will, I think, you know, I'd like to think. I don't want to predict anything. I would not have. I certainly didn't predict that Trump was going to win. That we'll have some. We'll face some corrective at the midterms, and we'll see. I mean, you know, the stock market today and yesterday, that wasn't open yesterday, is seeing some significant issues. And, you know, to the extent that a president is willing to take responsibility for a huge boom in the stock market, presumably he would have to take some responsibility for a large-scale bust, as is happening today.
And, of course, on Friday, it went down by 666 points.
Right.
666 being something in the conspiracy world that might resonate.
Yes, well, indeed.
Well, Mark Fenster, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Fenster, who's a professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida, whose research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on government regulation. He's the author of The Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the brazen example of the fox guarding the hen house with Mick Mulvaney moonlighting as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, destroying the agency from within. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amanda Werner, who's the Arbitration Campaign Manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, where she advocates strong consumer protection regulations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanda Werner.
Thanks for having me, Ian. I actually have a new position, though. I just joined Public Justice as their campaign strategist.
Well, that's good to know. And you, of course, photobombed a Senate hearing where the head of Equifax, the CEO, Richard Smith, was testifying. You were dressed as a Monopoly man, and that created quite a stir, and the video went viral. But now we learn that Mick Mulvaney, who's taken over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is going to give Equifax a free pass. They won't be punished for the fact that they allowed personal data on more than 143 million Americans to be released via hackers to the public. They're literally getting a get-out-of-jail-free pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, even though I think we saw more consumer outrage over this issue than pretty much any other issue we've seen, you know, including Wells Fargo and others, Mick Mulvaney has decided that now is the time that he wants to take the heat off Equifax, even though there have literally been, you know, no consequences for this company. Congress did a kind of one-and-done hearing on the subject, but there hasn't been any significant legislation, any significant penalties for this company at all.
Well, the other thing that Mulvaney is doing, of course, is, and the New York Times has done a big article on that in Monday's New York Times, they're basically, Mulvaney is going to give the payday lenders a free pass and undo all of the work that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did in reining them in. He's going to allow them to charge consumers 1,000% interest, worse than anything the mafia would even try to do. And on top of that, apparently the Payday Lenders Association are going to have their big annual meeting in April. Guess where? At one of Trump's resorts.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. Ever since Mick Mulvaney has taken over as acting director, he's really gone to work dismantling every piece of what the Consumer Bureau has been able to accomplish. And, you know, obviously there's a pending court case about whether or not he's even supposed to be acting director. We are of the opinion that he is not actually the rightful person at the head of this agency. But I think regardless, we can see that he has no respect for the fact that, you know, this is an agency built to protect consumers, and we're supposed to put the American people above these businesses and their profits, particularly when you're talking about really predatory companies like payday lenders who really can only benefit when they're, you know, hurting their consumers.
So what do you think makes this guy tick? Because I recall his press conference when he sort of buffaloed his way in to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And, of course, Cordray had appointed his deputy who's brought about the lawsuit, which is still, she's still in limbo. But he's sort of acted like a thug and took over, and he's just ripping it apart. But he didn't, of course, say that. He said he was going to protect the consumers. So what makes a guy like that tick? I mean, why would you want to be in a job where you're actually going to undo everything the job was meant to do?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it seems like that's a larger pattern for everyone that Trump has appointed, you know, from EPA administrators to, you know, Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education. He's traditionally picked people who have pretty much made an outright enemy of the sector that they're now overseeing. He's really made no pretense that he's trying to destroy the government from the inside out. But Mulvaney in particular, you know, honestly, the thing that seems to make him tick is campaign contributions. You know, there was just a report that came out this morning that he's received thousands of dollars from Equifax's Political Action Committee. Similarly, with pretty much every move he's made so far, we've seen that he, you know, delayed the implementation of a rule protecting prepaid card holders. Turns out that the lobbyists for prepaid cards gave him at least $13,000 in campaign contributions. Similar for the payday loans, we also found thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from these kind of companies. And in fact, you know, pretty much every decision he makes seems to be a follow the money kind of distinction.
And of course, now he's saying, well, I'm not in Congress, so can't be accused of, of quid pro quo, right?
Yeah, well, this is the exact, you know, revolving door problem we see all the time, is that these people come out of Congress and then they offer favors to the people who gave them campaign contributions. So even though you can't, you know, draw a direct line and say that's a bribe, it's essentially what they're doing in function. And, you know, the other thing, Mulvaney just came out the other day saying that he sent out this memo to CFPB staff saying that they are going to take, you know, a completely different direction from the approach that Director Cordray took. And one thing he said in particular that I think a lot of folks found really striking is that he's redefining the word consumer. And inside the word consumer, he's including businesses and industries and, you know, this other side of things that the Bureau is not actually supposed to prioritize at all. But he has now redefined the word consumer, so it essentially means everyone, and he's giving priority to businesses and industries that are not even supposed to be part of the CFPB's calculus.
And again, I'm speaking with Amanda Werner, who is the arbitration campaign manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, where she advocates for strong consumer protection regulations, and she's now a campaign strategist with Public Justice. So we're all sort of victims of this extraordinary phenomenon of having Dracula in charge of the blood bank, having people at every cabinet level who are dedicated to destroying the very functions of the government departments they oversee. And that is clearly happening. And I don't know that Trump is necessarily, he's hardly a micromanager. I don't think he knows what's going on, frankly. But he obviously doesn't care. What do you think's behind this? I mean, a lot of people think this is just basically a gift to the Koch brothers, that, or perhaps a payoff to them, that you know, these kind of ultra uber libertarians who want to shrink government down so that they can drown it in a bathtub. They're doing exactly what they say. I mean, I know they're ideologues, but the people that work for them, like Mulvaney, the hirelings, if you will, again, I still don't understand what makes them tick, apart from the fact that they're hirelings of the rich and powerful.
Well, I think what's particularly outrageous is that, you know, these folks don't even seem to have that kind of purity around their ideology. In one instance, they want to shrink down government so they can drown it in a bathtub. But in another instance, you know, you have folks that are, you know, micromanaging a teenager's decision about whether to get an abortion when she's being held, you know, detained for immigration. So I think we have not actually people who want government out of our lives. We have people who want government out of business and then government in every aspect of the rest of our lives, as long as they can control folks. So I think that's what I find particularly disturbing. If Trump wanted to take, you know, a fully libertarian position, that's one thing. But if it's just about the rich and powerful, you know, white men controlling the whole of society, I think that's profoundly disturbing. That is, unfortunately, the authoritarian pattern we're seeing. He's really tightening his grip on government rule, not actually decreasing it.
But the worst part of it is, surely, Amanda Werner, is that Trump's winning. I mean, he may well win on, he may well end up shutting down or neutering the Mueller investigation. He still hasn't released his tax returns. He's won on that round. He's flagrantly defying the emoluments clause in the Constitution by keeping his businesses going and obviously participating in them. And we don't know what kind of foreign policy decisions are made based upon his business dealings abroad with all kinds of sleazy kleptocrats and autocrats. So that's what's extraordinary is that, I mean, do you think that the fact that his daily antics get so much attention from the press, and remember the press gave him $5 billion worth of free advertising, which basically put him in the White House, is that a problem? In other words, we're all being distracted by the chaos, but we're not looking at the daily damage that people like Mulvaney and Scott Pruitt and Betsy DeVos are doing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's easy to win at a game when you've knocked over the table. And I think that's essentially what Trump is doing every day. Unfortunately, I do think that the media is giving disproportionate coverage to things like his tweets and his, you know, offensive antics and not enough to what he's actually doing to the machinery of the government. And one reason I think that's really important is because, you know, Trump obviously is an outrageous individual and inspires a lot of strong feelings in people on both sides of the aisle. But at the end of the day, his administration is much bigger than him alone. And even if, you know, Robert Mueller is successful and ultimately we see Trump removed from office because of these horrible things he's accused of, we're still going to have all these same people in place. And I think that's really the danger here is that we put all of our focus on Trump as the enemy and just want to get him out as opposed to actually looking at the damage that really the Republican Party and the Republican establishment is doing across the whole of government. There's not one thing that Trump has done so far that has not been co-signed by Paul Ryan, has not been co-signed by Mike Pence and others that are in his administration. I think we need to make sure that when we're looking to undo this damage, when hopefully we, you know, take back the White House and take back Congress, that we are not just looking at this one man and thinking that the problem is solved once he's gone.
And again, I'm speaking with Amanda Werner, who is the arbitration campaign manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, where she advocates for strong consumer protection regulations, and she's now a campaign strategist with Public Justice. So it seems obvious to me, and it appears obvious to you, that this is happening. Why then is it not clear to so many other Americans?
You know, I think it's becoming more and more clear by the day. Just in talking to folks that aren't as plugged into this, I feel like it's starting to seep into the broader conversation. But, you know, I do think there's a certain numbness going on. It's hard to see your country dismantled piece by piece, and I think a lot of people are very understandably getting overwhelmed by just the sheer magnitude of stories. I mean, that's the other piece, is we're, you know, both paying so much attention to Trump's daily actions, but just the sheer amount of news coming out and the sheer amount of scandal that we see every day is completely overwhelming. And I think even, you know, the best of us and the folks that are more the most inclined to be watching these things are also getting overwhelmed and getting cynical. And so, I mean, that's a tricky thing to figure out. I think partially we need to just, you know, keep reminding ourselves that it does not have to be like this. You know, there are folks that are keeping lists of what has been changing in the Trump administration. I think it's good for us to look back to the Obama years and remember how government is supposed to function and continue to hold Trump to that standard, even if he won't, you know, ever come close to it. But I think it's also important for, you know, folks to remember that it's not, at this point, it's not necessarily going to be incredibly helpful to be outraged at every little thing. And I do think that people who are actively fighting the resistance need to take proper care of themselves and not constantly be fueled by outrage, and instead be strategic and look toward 2018, look toward 2020, and really start building the movement that we'll need to get rid of these folks and undo the damage in the future.
Well, just in closing, Amanda Werner, back to the other outrage apart from Equifax, is that Mulvaney is going to give these payday lenders a free pass. And as I mentioned, their 1,000% interest gouging would make the mafia embarrassed. And the idea that, they're all going to have their annual conclave at Trump's resort in April. What is the, isn't there a connection, though, to the mainstream banks? Aren't they creating sort of shadow subsidiaries to profit from this disgusting attack on poor Americans?
Yeah, I mean, they've always been interconnected. You know, I think the payday lenders get some of the focus for being kind of these, like, small, scammy, bad actors. But really, I think they're just a, you know, slightly more extreme, small-scale version of what's going on Wall Street every day. This is pretty much the way that our current corporate system is built to profit, is by taking, you know, unseemly amounts from every American and turning that into profits. I think the tax bill that recently passed is a great example of how that kind of works. You know, Paul Ryan wants us to celebrate a secretary who's getting $150 extra per week, while we're seeing literally a trillion times that amount being given to corporate America. So I think Wall Street is built to function by taking advantage of the American consumer, and unfortunately now our one agency that was supposed to protect us from that is no longer going to. I think it's really important that not only we get Mulvaney out of there as quickly as possible, but that we get someone who's actually approved and vetted by Congress in there as soon as possible. Because that's the other thing, is I think Trump is kind of waiting it out so that he can have control of the Bureau for years to come. Because remember, this is a 5-year confirmed position. So he's got to get someone in there fast. Otherwise, he might have control over the Bureau, you know, potentially through 2021.
And just to make a note on what you said about Paul Ryan celebrating the secretary's getting a raise, it's not $150, it's $1.50.
$1.50, to be very clear. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Amanda Werner.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Werner, who's the Arbitration Campaign Manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, where she advocates strong consumer protection regulations, and she's now a campaign strategist with Public Justice. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the new nuclear posture review that mirrors the reckless Russian doctrine of deploying more low-yield nuclear weapons, which increase the potential for their use.
Get from out the road when you get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K cave, a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumping, get your trickles. The best ball is pitching and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he about to change the price again. They go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, album's thrilling in fear. It won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jonathan Granoff, who's the president of the Global Security Institute, who serves on numerous governing and advisory boards, including the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, Jane Goodall's Institute, the NGO Committee on Disarmament and Middle Powers Initiative. And he's the senior advisor and United Nations representative of the Permanent Secretariat of the World Summits of Nobel Peace Laureates, and Ambassador for Peace, Security, and Nuclear Disarmament of the Parliament of the World's Religions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Granoff.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. And the treaty, the START treaty, goes into effect between the U.S. and Russia on long-range nuclear arsenals on Monday. But in President Trump's State of the Union address a couple of days ago, he talked about the need to modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal. So it seems that this new nuclear posture review commits the U.S. to basically copying what Putin is doing, which is exactly the dynamic that we had during the Cold War. Quite often or not, we built new weapon systems based upon what we thought the Russians were doing as opposed to what they were really doing. But either way, this is a bad movie that we've already seen.
It's a much more dangerous movie than during the Cold War because it sends a message to many other countries that the United States is no longer committed to fulfilling its legal duties under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And it is re-stimulating a new arms race, a lethal arms race, lethal both in the theft of resources from addressing climate and poverty and protecting the oceans, lethal in the sense of spending over $1.2 trillion, which we cannot afford, and lethal in the sense of lowering the threshold of the use of nuclear weapons, in a sense, coming up with new uses of nuclear weapons. Exactly the wrong direction, the wrong bus.
So what's your sense then of where, I mean, it's the START Treaty, of course, has its genesis going back through Reagan and Bush, Clinton and Obama. Is that sort of moribund or irrelevant to what's happening now?
I think it's very relevant. So let's give a little bit of context of the START Treaty and these treaties. It really begins with the KGB and the CIA noting how close we came to ending civilization in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then studying and concluding that absent some legal constraints, there would be dozens of nuclear weapon states. So the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was negotiated, and that is a treaty that in which the nuclear weapon states promised to negotiate the elimination of nuclear weapons, and now 182 countries have forsworn the weapons in that exchange. Richard Nixon brought that treaty into force. He also did the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which assured mutual vulnerability and thus made the mutual assured destruction doctrine somewhat logical because we would refrain from defending ourselves and make sure we wouldn't use nuclear weapons. And then, of course, Ronald Reagan was a passionate advocate for nuclear disarmament once he concluded that a nuclear war, to quote him, could not be won and therefore must never be fought. He also concluded that leaving less than 10 minutes to decide the future of humanity, should there be the perception of an attack against the United States, was madness, to quote his, to quote him, and he began the negotiations for the START Treaty to lower the number of nuclear weapons, which was brought into effect by George Bush Sr., who lowered the arsenal, I think, about 9,000 weapons. And then George W. Halved the nuclear arsenal, bringing it down to the size around what we have now of around 14,500 weapons. And this START Treaty, which was negotiated by the Obama administration, lowers the number of deployed nuclear weapons to a number far above what would annihilate civilization many times over. So although it's a trajectory going in the right direction, it's woefully inadequate. So under the START Treaty that will come into effect, both Russia and the United States will still end up deploying mutually at each other nearly 3,000 nuclear warheads. So, it is only a symbolic movement at best. It is not the clear, unambiguous commitment that's needed, which is the commencement of negotiations on a full comprehensive treaty eliminating nuclear weapons.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Granoff, who's the president of the Global Security Institute, who serves on numerous governing and advisory boards, including the Lawyers Committee for Nuclear Policy, the Jane Goodall Institute, the NGO Committees on Disarmament and Middle Powers Initiative, and he's also a senior advisor and United Nations representative of the Permanent Secretariat of the World Summits of Nobel Peace Laureates and Ambassador for Peace, Security and Nuclear Disarmament of the Parliaments of the World's Religions. So, and I might add to what you just told us there in terms of Reagan, you know, it all started with the KGB and the CIA getting together after the Cuban crisis. But there was also the Abel Archer crisis in November of 1983, and that had a profound effect on Ronald Reagan, who was a real hawk when he first started out. And, you know, Cap Weinberger was talking about nuclear decapitation, which the gerontocracy in the Kremlin took very personally. Reagan said the Soviets would end up on the ash heap of history. They interpreted that as a nuclear threat. And, of course, President Reagan was having fun taunting the wounded bear. But Abel Archer really shook Reagan up when he learned that his words were taken seriously by the Russian leadership, and they almost went to nuclear war over nothing. It's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, but to have one by accident is unconscionable. And this new nuclear posture review leads us more into that territory, doesn't it? Because they're talking about low-yield nuclear weapons, battlefield nuclear weapons. What are they going to do, get down to the level of having a nuclear hand grenade?
Well, first of all, you should understand what the term low yield means to the Pentagon. Low yield means anything under 20 kilotons. And that would mean that the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, which they called a low yield weapon, a tactical weapon, would be called a tactical weapon because it was about 15 kilotons. And this statement of the so-called tactical weapons is contrary to what the head of the Strategic Command, General Hayden, said, that there's no such thing really as a tactical weapon. They're all strategic. I mean, if you drop a weapon that's 20 kilotons, or the size of Hiroshima, to call that low yield, it renders language. It's preposterous. And the position that the administration has taken, there was a treaty negotiated in July called the Prohibition Treaty that 122 nations said it's time to prohibit nuclear weapons. And they're calling that destabilizing, whereas the actual the argument in this nuclear posture review that's just come out is that we need to have more lower-yield nuclear weapons, maybe, say, 5 kilotons, say the third of the size of Hiroshima, which is absolutely devastating. More of those because the large ones are self-deterring. They're too large. We wouldn't use them. Therefore, in order to make sure that people believe that we would use our nuclear weapons and render the use of nuclear weapons less likely, we need to build more smaller nuclear weapons, which others will believe are more likely to be used in order to render the threat of use less likely. So this borders on, I guess, Alice in Wonderland on LSD. The logic is simply insane. To quote Robert McNamara, the former Secretary of Defense, you can't use nuclear weapons against a country that has them. It's suicidal. It's absolutely illegal and immoral to use them against a country that doesn't have them. And they're no use against terrorists. So they're mad and insane to keep. It's time to get rid of them. Now, that call to get rid of them is embodied in a legal commitment of the United States. And that's what's important to me as an American, which is that Article 6 of our Constitution makes treaties the supreme law of the land. They're not real estate deals to be renegotiated. It is called the Supremacy Clause. That's very serious. Our founding fathers wanted treaties to be taken seriously. And when we degrade a commitment under a treaty, we not only degrade the stability of the international order, which is pretty serious, we also degrade the Constitution of the United States, the document that keeps us as a nation. So this nuclear posture review's failure to explicitly reaffirm
commitments under the existing treaty addressing nuclear weapons, to me, is even more serious than the things in the treaty. Things in the treaty, it would shock people if they realized the price tag on this stuff. I mean, for example, it calls for replacing a dozen Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines. It calls for building new nuclear-capable bombers. It calls for re-energizing the B-83 bomb, which is the equivalent of 1.2 megatons or 75 Hiroshimas. This is crazy. Who are we going to drop these things on? And the idea that any country would think that our deterrent capacity needs to be upgraded in order to be fearful of us is preposterous. Just a little while ago, in the Balkans, Russian and U.S. troops were fighting under joint command. There's absolutely no reason for us to be threatening to annihilate Russia, or Russia to annihilate us, or China, our bank, to annihilate us. It's time to change the course. Instead of relying on fear, to recognize our shared interest in ensuring a sustainable climate, health of the oceans, fulfilling the sustainable development goals, which we've committed to at the United Nations. This is really a theft. And that's why, that interesting article today in the New York Times, in which people not really associated with nuclear disarmament, but, I'll just quote Andrew Weber, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Obama administration. He directed the oversight of the nation's nuclear arsenal. He called the new plan dangerous folly. As he said, we can already deter any strike. We've plenty of low-yield weapons. The new plan is a fiction created to justify the making of new nuclear arms. They'll just increase the potential for their use and for miscalculation. The administration's logic is Kafkaesque. I only disagree with him. I think it's more like the Mad Hatter. So it's something that people should demand that we don't fund. We just shouldn't fund this. It's a big waste of money.
And serious money at that. And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Granoff, who's the president of the Global Security Institute, who serves on numerous governing and advisory boards, including the Lawyers Committee for Nuclear Policy, the Jane Goodall Institute, the NGO Committees on Disarmament and Middle Powers Initiative, and he's also a senior advisor and United Nations representative of the Permanent Secretariat of the World Summits of Nobel Peace Laureates and Ambassador for Peace, Security and Nuclear Disarmament of the Parliaments of the World's Religions. But the quote that you just gave of Andrew Weber's, he talked this new nuclear posture review and the plan that Trump talked about at the State of the Union as a dangerous folly, but he also said we're simply mirroring the reckless Russian doctrine. And then the rest of the quote was as you laid out. So what do you do about the Russian doctrine, that if they're moving in this insane direction themselves, and Putin, of course, is basically the glue that holds Russia together, is anti-Americanism now, particularly as he goes into this election.
Sure. So if Russia wants to waste its money on new nuclear bombs, there's got to be, first of all, that it doesn't mean that we should waste our money. But more importantly, we need to address why is Russia afraid of us? Are they afraid of us because we don't have military bases surrounding them? Are they afraid of us because we didn't deploy so-called missile defenses in Eastern Europe to prevent Iran, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, from attacking Western Europe, which would have no interest in doing, which the Russians say are forward deployments for forward missile deployments, or lowering the threshold of use? These are things that the Russians are genuinely afraid of. And the Russian mentality is really very much a siege mentality. It's a very unstable country compared to the United States. It's poor. It's a resource extraction economy. To mirror their folly is absurd. We should be changing the very definition of security with them. The irony, of course, is because right now the Democratic Party is highlighting Trump's improprieties with Russia, and therefore the Trump administration would be hard-pressed to really change the equation with Russia in a positive direction. That's the irony of the moment. But with nuclear weapons, need to transcend partisanship. That's why I highlighted the history of Republican action on the subject from Reagan and Nixon and the Bushes. This is not a partisan issue. This is a smart, dumb issue.
I agree. But you have to add to what the catalog that you've given us of our own folly on this side. I mean, on the Russian side, frankly, it is a different situation which we've never had to deal with before. We've never had to deal with the combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia, as they call it in Russia, and nuclear weapons. But on our side, it seems that George W. Bush, with the folly of the Iraq invasion, has sent the signal out to all of the so-called rogue states in the world, in particular North Korea, that we'll invade you on the fiction that you might have nuclear weapons. So surely that has become an impetus for people like the North Koreans to get nuclear weapons, because the U.S. has already sent the signal that... And the same with the Iranians. I mean, that was negotiated away, but Trump is trying to get rid of that deal that we have with the Iranians. So that's what I worry about. The fastest growing arsenal in the world, of course, is the Pakistanis, and they play a game of basically saying, you've got to give us aid because we don't want our nuclear weapons to fall in the hands of terrorists, which the government, or at least the ISI and the Pakistan military, fund, nurture, and deploy terrorists. That's pretty...
It's much worse than you portrayed it, in a sense that Saddam Hussein gave up his weapons of mass destruction, and he got caught cheating, and he gave them up, and he didn't have any, and so we killed him. And Muammar Gaddafi similarly gave up his weapons of mass destruction, and he got killed. And that's not a really good message to send to the North Koreans. So we're starting out behind the eight ball, and we have to build trust. And do we want to invade North Korea? Do we want to destroy this tyrannical, fascist, family-run kleptocracy? Is that our goal? Is that what our policy is, or is our policy to stop them from being a threat to us?
Well, then it's got to
be clear.
Sure, but mostly they're a threat to South Korea, and our policy, even a bloody nose strategy that they're talking about now, is going to end up with Seoul being wiped out and millions and thousands, whatever, who knows how many are going to die, along with the U.S. families and dependents and the troops there. So that is the most extraordinary part about it. But Trump is obsessed with nuclear weapons. He's a scary guy. I mean, I'm telling you, the first briefing he got when he was in the transition, he kept asking the briefers who were trying to tell him about what's happening in the world. He wanted to know about what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. And his State of the Union address he spends every day hammering Madison McMaster to do something about Kim Jong-un. He wants to do something. He's not satisfied with anything short of, you know, either wiping the guy out or giving him a bloody nose.
That's why I say there's a failure of clarity. If our goal is regime change through violence in North Korea, it could lead to a terrible escalation, and certainly the death of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people fast. And actually, not only the use by North Korea of some of its nuclear weapons, but they might, even worse, is they might sell them to sub-state actors, terrorists, who could use them anywhere in the world, would destroy the global economy. There's a lack of sobriety in this. You know, we used to call it mutually assured destruction, but the recent studies show that if a mere 100 were to go off, say, in South Asia between India and Pakistan, terribly unstable place right now, let's say there was a, like the Hawaiian alert were to take place in either of those countries, they wouldn't have very much time to determine whether it was accurate or not. And somebody might launch. Certainly, there are generals in either of these countries that are just ready to go. And if they did have a robust exchange, it would throw up to 5 tons of soot into the stratosphere. And that would render agriculture, as we know it, dysfunctional for at least a decade, killing billions of human beings. Now, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to be posturing this way. You raised the issue of Abel Archer. These were exercises that the then Soviets believed were preparations for an attack. But there have been many, many computer errors and other human errors that have brought us right to the brink of annihilation. In fact, right around that time, and there's a great movie called The Man Who Saved the World, there was a colonel in the Soviet Union, Colonel Stanislav Petrov, that every one of us is beholden to, because there was an odd cloud formation that appeared when the sun hit it to be a full-scale American launch in 1983, around the same time as the Abel Archer.
Sure.
And right after the Korean airliner was shot down. And so the Soviets was a crisis moment in their mind, and they thought we were ready to attack. And he didn't pass the information up the command and control. And had he done so, they would have sent off over 10,000 nuclear warheads at us, and we wouldn't be here today. It turns out that in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we now know that there were field commanders in Cuba with dozens of nuclear weapons fully ready to be used. Had Curtis LeMay, had the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had their way and invaded Cuba, they would have launched them, and we wouldn't be here today. There was once a training tape accidentally put into our computers that set off all the computers as if we were under attack, and for a very, very short time, the world hung in the balance. There was a nuclear bomb dropped in the Carolinas that almost exploded. I mean, there have been so many of these, and the idea of continuing this venture when we promised to negotiate elimination, and parenthetically, if the International Court of Justice unanimously ruled that there's a duty to negotiate elimination. And the American people don't realize that there are 5 nuclear weapons free zones in the world, making the southern hemisphere virtually nuclear weapons free. And the vast majority of nations are demanding a prohibition against nuclear weapons. So we're out of step with history, we're out of step with our legal duties, and we're wasting our money.
Well, Jonathan Granoff, I thank you very much. I'm afraid we run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Granoff, who's the president of the Global Security Institute, who serves on numerous governing and advisory boards, including the Lawyers Committee for Nuclear Policy, the Jane Goodall Institute, the NGO Committee on Disarmament and Middle Powers Initiative, and he's the senior advisor and United Nations representative of the Permanent Secretariat of the World Summits of Nobel Peace Laureates and Ambassador for Peace, Security, and Nuclear Disarmament of the Parliament of the World's Religions. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.